Hello, 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 everybody. I am Pedro.
And I am Meredith.
And this is Gritty Reboot.
Yeah.
So today we are covering perhaps one of the biggest movies we've ever covered, right?
Yeah, I would say so.
I think that's a pretty good way to put it. I think The Abyss is one of the most well-crafted movies that I've ever seen, but I was surprised how much I didn't love it on this viewing.
Yeah, I've never really liked this movie. I didn't like it when I saw it way back when. I don't like it now.
I don't feel like it's necessarily changed with time. I know, and for a fact right now, I just want to state that we watched the theatrical cut of the film. We did not watch the director's cut special edition.
Yeah.
I did not have the extra ending with the waves and everything, the added scenes and stuff like that. This was only, like I said, the theatrical cut. And even with that, I still felt the film to be a little hollow at times. And I guess I was surprised by it because I remember really loving this film, and this viewing left me surprisingly cold.
Yeah.
Despite how much I feel about the way it's put together, because it's pretty amazing otherwise.
The movie is somehow, it's well crafted, but it's somehow hollow.
Yeah.
There needed to be a little bit more character development.
Yeah, I think that one of the things I always appreciate in James Cameron movies is how he's able to do some really simple character work to make you understand or feel where a character is coming from. And I thought this was probably like the weakest of his attempts to try to build characters in a movie.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was one of the things. I think Ed Harris helps out a lot because he's fantastic like he always is. And, yeah. And Michael Biehn probably delivers the performance of his career in this movie.
But you can tell they're all being tortured.
There is a feel of abuse,
yes.
That maybe comes out through the movie.
Yes.
And I guess we'll certainly talk about that as we get into the...
Oh, I have loads to say.
Yeah, I assume we're going to talk about. And I probably have a few clips that'll correspond to probably things you're going to talk about.
Yeah.
So this is a wild movie, but at the end of the day, I'm sort of talking negative about it, but I still think I'm going to give it a 7. Because it's not like it isn't well put together. It's not like it isn't incredibly watchable. It's just, it can be a little slow in some spots. And I you know, your emotions won't lie to you. And I just didn't connect with anything really in this movie.
I'm going to give it a 6.
A 6?
Yeah.
The internet just come for it right now.
Yeah, it's not my favorite James Cameron movie. In fact, it probably is my least favorite. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think I'm going to say that.
What's your favorite?
What's my favorite?
Yeah.
Probably Terminator 2.
Probably Terminator 2?
Oh, no. It's a cross between Terminator 2 and True Lies.
True Lies is really good. True Lies really gets kind of forgotten, but that's not because it's a bad movie. It's just because
it's fucking
there's
great.
So many other great films.
What's your favorite?
Oh, I mean, it's Avatar 2.
Ugh.
It's Avatar.
Not that I didn't like enjoy that movie. I did.
Yeah.
I saw it in the theater, for God's sakes.
Well, I think the thing about it is Avatar is the highest grossing movie ever made. Therefore, it is the greatest movie ever made. Does that logic not hold?
No.
No, honestly, probably the film of his that I love the most is Aliens.
Oh, yeah. I forget about that.
That's probably the film of his that I love the most.
Yeah, that's probably mine too.
Yeah, I think
I take mine back.
Yeah, if you're going to put a gun to my head, like Aliens has my favorite scene in any movie ever.
I know.
When Newt has been captured and Ripley goes back into the belly of the beast.
And she goes armed.
Yeah, it's such a great whole scene. She's like, "No, they took everything from me. Not again."
Yeah.
I love everything about it, the way you build to it. Like the way you sometimes when a character does something, you question, like, would they really do that? Could they be that heroic? You don't question that at all for the way James Cameron crafted that story for Ripley. You know, she don't care if she's not coming out of there. She's going to take as many of those things with her as she can, and she's going to do whatever she can to save Newt.
Yeah.
And that's what makes it great. And I didn't have that feeling in this one, like Terminator 2 gives me, and or even Avatar, you know? I think that's a better movie all around, even though I have a similar issue with Avatar. That I think that's really well crafted, but a bit hollow.
Yeah,
this is the 80s Avatar.
Are we going to just go down the James Cameron list?
Is that all we're doing? This is not a review of The Abyss. We're just talking about James Cameron
movies. Maybe we should stick to The Abyss.
Let's lay the trivia down.
All right. to simulate the moment where Bud free falls rapidly underwater down an abyssal trench, Ed Harris was towed sideways across a fake rock wall. This was to avoid the need for Harris to equalize during a descent. Equalizing is an unglamorous process that isn't great for close-ups. This was, to put it lightly, a terrible situation for Harris, who recalls in Under Pressure, holding your breath, you can't see, you can't move, you're 45 feet underwater, you don't have any air supply of your own, and they're going to drag you to 200 feet across the bottom of this tank while you're acting. After a successful test with Charlie Arneson, one of Harris's stunt doubles, the actor strapped himself into the tow rig. Between a rehearsal and one of the first takes, Terry Kirby, one of Harris's safety divers, got tangled in the cord. When Harris signaled that he was out of oxygen, the rig came to a halt. Harris clung to the wall, awaiting his air supply. With no air supply came. I was hanging there out of breath with no air, thinking, this is great, recalls Harris in the dock. Another crew member swam over to Harris and improperly inserted his extra regulator into Harris's mouth, causing the actor to inhale a lung full of half air, half water. For a split second, I really thought it was a goner, he continues. Then Al Giddings, the underwater director of photography, ripped the rag out and gave Harris his own extra air supply correctly. In the documentary, the actor recalls bursting into tears during his drive home that night. There was a part of me that was really disappointed in myself for not being able to do this thing. And there was also a part of me that just didn't know what to do. I really thought I was going to die for a second, and it also pissed me off that I was afraid of that. Ed was probably the ultimate trooper in the world, James Cameron remarks. If he wasn't before the abyss, he certainly was after.
This was a nightmare shoot, a legendary nightmare shoot. The abuse.
Well, I have more. Yeah.
There's tons of stories about that. And that's Ed Harris's story. And actually, I think Ed Harris almost drowned more than once on the set.
Yeah, I can imagine. He sounds like he had a really terrible time.
Yeah, I think
worst out of everybody.
The thing about it is, like, I think almost everybody had a bad experience on this movie. And let me ask you something before you keep going in your trivia. Do you have any facts about Michael Biehn?
Not really.
Okay, because I have a clip about Mr. Biehn. And once again, this is him on the Rosenbaum podcast. And he was asked about the abyss. And he talks about one of his bad experiences with the dive.
Movie. I had a great time. The only thing that I didn't like about it was I wasn't always on the set.
Right.
You know, because I was playing the bad guy. So it was a lot.
Does not mirror what everybody else had.
Right. Yeah. So anyway.
Michael Biehn loved his time on set.
And, you know, they have lights underwater, however they figure that out. And, you know, we're working and we've been doing it for weeks and weeks and weeks working underwater and doing different stuff. And it's a huge tank, millions and millions and millions of gallons of water. And they put these beads on the top because the light was coming through and Jim wanted to be able to light it properly. So they put all these little tiny beads and it was all black on top. So no light would come in. And we're down there. And we had an underwater oxygen tank that you just plug into and you fill up your oxygen and then then you're off and you're wandering around and until your shot's ready, you're bouncing around, you know. I used to, you know, I told you I was a wake and bake guy for 40 years right. or whatever, you know, and I had a blast. I had a great time, especially doing the underwater stuff.
But nothing happened.
So what happened was like all of a sudden it just, everything went black, like, they lost all power and there were three or four actors under there, the entire crew, but they all have scuba gear on. They have scuba, they could just, And it went from like me talking to you like closing your eyes. I mean, that's
scary.
It was weird. I mean, I have Michael oxygen, Biehn but
doesn't know
first,
fear.
Your first thought is, well,
I guess not. Like, I guess he's just like chill with everything.
He's like, I almost drowned, but you know, it's a pretty cool day. Chris Harris is good.
I don't know where we are. I don't know how much oxygen I have. What the F is going on? So,
did you hear anything?
No, of course not. Underwater? No.
I thought maybe they had like little.
No. All right. They did. Well, Jim could talk to us, but like no, how Rosamond nobody was really communicating.
How long were you there?
We were there for probably about 2 minutes.
Which seemed like eternity.
It seemed like a long time. And then I thought to myself, Michael, you have a practical light on you. And a practical light is one that your character would use in a movie. They call it a practical light, right? So I'm like, oh my God, I've got my flashlight deal. So I pull that out, I turn that on, and people started just coming towards me, you know, because I was the only light underneath. Minutes of people going, what the fuck? The safety diver. So
all the actors?
Everybody. Everybody who was down there.
Whatever, dude.
Because
they didn't have one. No, I like the story.
Nobody had one except for my practical light.
Michael Biehn led
everyone
to safety.
And then Jim kind of rounded us all out and with hand signals and stuff said, like, you know, follow me. We're going to go out this way. And so like Jim Cameron to the rescue, as always, he was the
always.
Man. I mean, if you're ever in a foxhole, you want to be in a foxhole with that guy. And, you know, nobody was expecting it. And it was scary. It was scary. You know, wow, as Jim was leading the group and we're all each other. We're all like,
I'm now
going to
call him Jim.
Each other.
I don't think Jim you get to you know, call him Jim.
Why?
Sounds like he's been to his house.
Where he was and how to get out. And by the time, you know, 30 or 40 seconds of doing
those guys
that
don't blow together.
All of a sudden,
it's been in two of his movies.
Came back on again. So that was a scary experience for me.
That is crazy.
Yeah, so that's Michael Biehn talking about almost dying like it was just a regular day at the office. He seemed to have a pretty fun time where everyone else seemed to have hated every moment of this shoot.
Yeah. Weird that he had that experience. Mm-hmm. Real oxygenated fluorocarbon fluid was used in the rat fluid breathing scene. Dr. Johannes Kilstra and Dr. Peter Bennett of Duke University pioneered this technique and consulted on the film, giving detailed instructions on how to prepare the fluid. The only reason for cutting to the actors' faces was to avoid showing the rats defecating from momentary panic as they began breathing the fluid.
Yeah, I stumbled on that same fact as well, that was the only reason it's not like a straight shot, because they're really being scared into breathing in the water, basically.
Yeah.
And when they realize that they're going to drown, they shit themselves, as we all would in that situation. We're no better than a rat in that scenario. And James Cameron had to cut around that. How fucked is this scene?
Yeah.
I mean, we're going to talk about it when we get there, but like, it's amazing that he got to do that.
No shit.
That someone didn't say, hey, Jim, hey, Jimmy boy, I don't think it's a great idea to drown a mouse in amniotic fluid. And even if it works, and it'll work, but even if it works, it may not be like the best scene because it's cut out of the British version for good reason.
Yeah.
I think there's a number of countries where that scene is cut.
Ed Harris reportedly punched James Cameron in the face after he kept filming while he was nearly drowning.
Yeah. So James Cameron could have dropped everything and run to Ed Harris to help him, or, you know, we're already here. We might as well get the shot, right? You know, it'd be pretty cool looking. And so he had a right to punch out James Cameron, at least in my opinion. So it's fair enough. I sympathize with Ed Harris in that situation. You would hope that like somebody would care about your well-being more than the making of the film.
Mm-hmm.
But he should have known Jim Cameron by that point.
He should have.
Yeah. And known that his life meant nothing to him. He would build a cyborg to bring Ed Harris back to finish the film before he'd give a shit about him living or dying.
Wow.
Yeah, that's how deep James Cameron is on this one. Jim, my close personal friend, Jim Cameron.
He's not your friend.
No.
He's Michael Biehn's
friend. Michael Biehn, but I'm Michael Biehn's close personal friend.
No, you're not.
That was me interviewing him earlier.
No. Very few scenes involve stunt people. When Bud drags Lindsay back to the rig, that's really Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio. Holding her breath.
Mastrantonio.
When the rig is being flooded and characters are running from water, drowning behind closed doors, and dodging exploding parts of the rig, those are all actors, not stunt people.
Yeah. James Cameron was a madman because he wanted to see people's faces. And because of that, like, that's why people went through all these crazy links and this thing got really dangerous. But you know what? I'll tell you something. It's pretty awesome to see somebody, like a real person's face out there when you're watching underwater stuff.
Yeah.
Like, they're not cheating it. Like, when we watch Leviathan, what do we first think? Well, they're Stryfer wet.
Yeah.
You know, they're, you know, in Deep Star 6, everything's too dark and murky to see anything. In this movie, everything's clear as possible out there.
Yeah, pretty good.
Yeah, because James Cameron wants you to see the effort that he went to pull all that off. That he was willing to kill any man to achieve this goal.
Absolutely. During the rigorous and problematic shoot, the cast and crew began calling the film by various derogatory names, such as Son of Abyss, The Abuse, and Life's Abyss, and Then You Die.
I like Life's Abyss, and Then You Die. I saw the t-shirts they had printed up for that. Yeah. It's actually pretty funny.
Director James Cameron said that he got so tired from working 6 days a week, 10 hours a day, sometimes more, that he would sometimes fall asleep during dinner in bed, waking up in the morning with half-eaten plate on his chest and clenching a fork in his hand. Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
Mastrantonio.
Reportedly suffered a physical and emotional breakdown because she was pushed so hard on the set. And Ed Harris had to pull over his car at one time while driving home because he burst into spontaneous.
Ed Harris had to weep at some
openly.
Point. Openly. Yeah. The toughest man who ever lived had to pull over and just weep with exhaustion.
Basically, I want everyone to know how bad it was for the actor.
Yeah. So underwater shooting.
I'm going to continue.
Is a nightmare.
Yeah.
A God's damned nightmare.
James Cameron himself nearly drowned during production while his feet were way down at the bottom of a giant water tank during filming. His assistant director had failed to warn him to refill his oxygen, and realizing that he was running out of air, Cameron called for help to underwater DP Al Giddings. However, Giddings couldn't hear him. He was near deaf from an old diving bell accident.
Yeah.
With no one else nearby, Cameron realized he had to go topside as soon as possible. He quickly realized his helmet, harness, and weights and started to swim with great speed to the surface, exhaling all the way in order to prevent lung damage from decompression. One of the safety divers held him down and gave him a regulator, but it was broken and only produced water. Cameron tried to release himself, but the diver, thinking that Cameron was simply having a panic attack, held him even tighter. Cameron only survived because he punched the diver in the face and reached the surface before passing out. The AD and the diver were fired the same day.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yes. Can you imagine that diver's like, oh man, oh, Jimmy Cameron's in danger. I'm going to save the director and I'm going to be the hero of the day. And instead he almost murders him.
Yeah.
Which would have also made him the hero of the day.
Crazy.
But honestly, like, it's at least... The thing about James Cameron is, like, he's not going to put an actor in a situation he's not really going to go into. Because he had himself in that same danger. I mean, he almost died there. You know, I think anybody else who wouldn't have the power to punch a man underwater and push him back with that, the great strength of James Cameron, anybody else wouldn't have been able to really get out of that situation or be able to drop his weights as fast. You know, that, you know, he could have easily died there. So, I mean, he was in the same danger. I think we saw that clip the other day about the helicopter in Terminator 2 that goes under the bridge, and the camera guy, like, listen, like, I think the stunt operator's great. I think he's going to make it, but if he doesn't and you do the shot I want, I'll end up dead. So Cameron drove the car vehicle himself and got the shot because he believed in, because he's like, no, if you don't do it, I will. I believe it's going to work. It's going to go great. So, you know, he would have died there. Not unlike, you know, John Landis killing kids left and right.
Yeah.
Is that a cheap shot?
Difference.
Yeah. Well, you know, I Cameron would kill any man. And listen, people died making Titanic. You know, a lot of crew members did. A lot of people drowned. So, I mean, they're not always clean. So that's the thing.
What kind of insurance is on a movie that where people drown?
Well, it depends on what kind of people they are. If it's Ed Harris, you're in deep shit. You know, if it's, you know, a crew member in a foreign country. Yeah, it's not that big a deal.
That's bullshit.
Yeah, it's not that big a deal. Yeah. So, I mean, sometimes it happens, you know, the crew guys get hurt. Nobody gives a shit. You know, so sometimes, you know, the lower guys, they, you know, they end up dead. You know, it's a matter of accounting.
more production adversities and setbacks. There were engineering delays that slowed down production on the never-used nuclear reactor that served as the water tank as well as the sets within. And when the tank was finally filled, thunderstorms and pipe ruptures complicated things. The tank was so huge that it had its own weather, and the water was often too murky to film. Local goats sometimes invaded the set, destroying equipment and urinating over the floors. Delays caused shooting days to last an average of 15 to 18 hours near the end, which caused exhaustion and agitation among cast and crew, who already had a tough time dealing with James Cameron's relentless pace and dictatorial behavior. The constant cold and submersion caused many to come down with ear and sinus infections. There were many near-drowning accidents on set, and finally, filming was delayed one day due to a bomb threat.
What's the story on the bomb threat?
I don't know.
Yeah, I haven't heard about that. That was a good one. There was a lot of things in there I didn't know. I didn't know about the goats. See, those are the practical things about shooting in a location that you may not realize about the wilderness and stuff around there. Is like you might have to deal with like bobcats that attack like crew members, or you know, vultures that are going to come in and try to steal your craft service.
Yeah.
There's weird things that sort of happen when you're shooting outdoors, and that's a very strange location. They made their own ocean, basically.
James Cameron's brother, Mike Cameron, plays a dead crewman inside the sunken submarine. To accomplish this, he had to hold his breath under 25 feet of water while also allowing a crab to crawl out of his mouth. The shot took 5 takes, and Mike had to crush the crab twice because Jim took too long to set the lights.
That's crazy to me. And all of the guys in that ship are people. None of them are mannequins or dummies. They're all people holding their breath for the madness of James Cameron.
Yeah.
Like there's guys in the background. A homie just hanging out back there is risking drowning so James Cameron can fill the shot. You know, like that's wild and insane to me. Mm-hmm. If you really think about it, you know, I mean, yeah, they look good because they're real people. They look real, but wouldn't a mannequin work just as well?
You think I'm done too?
Yeah.
I'm not done.
Yeah. It's just a crazy like feat that he asked these guys to go through.
I want everybody to know what some fucking dude put these people.
Just some fucking dude.
Yeah.
Some homie.
It's James Cameron. Made a robot. Is it really worth like your fucking life? And it's not even that great of a movie. I gave it a 6 earlier.
Yeah, I mean, I know people love this movie, but
not Godfather.
We're not one of them, so
yeah,
we're not one of those people.
The water in the two tanks was chlorinated heavily to prevent microbes growing in it. This caused skin burns, as well as many of the actors' hair to become green and even white. Due to this, the crew had to apply Vaseline to their skin and hair for protection while filming for several hours underwater. On top of everything else.
Well, I mean, it is just a giant body of water.
Yeah.
I mean, that's all it is. You just basically made a disease pit and you shot a movie in it for 6 months.
Yeah.
And then they just tried to keep it as clean as they could.
Cast members had to become certified divers before filming began. The Deep Core crew started training together in the Caribbean 1 month before filming. In order to create a sense of camaraderie, Ed Harris was not among them, as he was still filming another movie, so he got a certificate while training in a lake nearby. The actors playing the SEALs received a separate military training. At the end of the shoot, Harris was the most accomplished diver, nearly professional level, despite not having trained a single day in the actual ocean. That's how much he was in the water.
He got that good at diving that he was almost a professional deep sea diver.
Yeah.
Without ever going in a real ocean, just James Cameron's fake ocean, which is far more dangerous than a real ocean.
Hell ocean.
Hell ocean.
Okay. Talking a little bit more about the rats.
Let's just make a podcast about how much James Cameron loves to torture people. And occasionally make cinema.
And animals.
Too. Yeah.
He doesn't.
He loves to torture people, animals. You got somebody, James Cameron will torture him, all right? If he thinks he can turn a profit, he will make you feel pain like you've never experienced.
Well, remember what Kate Winslet said on the Titanic.
Yeah. She went back and worked with him.
Yeah.
Yeah, she went back and worked with him.
I can't believe it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he is James Cameron, so.
Yeah. You
know, he can almost kill you, and you're like, well, you know what? I could use the hit. what a dickhole.
It's Fluid breathing is a reality. 5 rats were used for 5 different takes, all of whom survived and were given antibiotic shocks by a vet. The rat that actually appeared in the film died of natural causes a few weeks before the film opened. According to James Cameron, the scene with the rat had to be edited out of the UK movie version because the royal veterinarian felt that it was painful for the rat. James Cameron repeatedly assures the rat is used for this take didn't suffer any harm.
He's like, no, I guarantee you the rat's fine.
Yeah.
I know he died of natural causes, but his family had bad hearts. Yeah. So, you know, he was due. I don't trust James Cameron. Listen, like I said, he'll kill whatever it takes to get the box office growth. This wasn't even a hit, and he was killing rats left and right, apparently.
This is my last fact. I swear.
Okay.
Yeah. I know there's a whole lot of facts.
It's fine.
They were all good.
We're 45 minutes in.
Well, it'll be a long one. The idea for the film came to James Cameron when he attended a science lecture before about deep sea diving and liquid breathing in high school. He wrote a short story about a group of scientists in a laboratory at the bottom of the ocean on the edge of the Cayman Trench. When signs of life come from the trench, the scientists dive in one at a time, never to return or be heard from again. When the last remaining scientist follows him to find out what happened, he ends up in a depth-induced psychosis. Cameron said that he put the draft away at the time, but when it was time to dust it off, he couldn't remember where he left it, so he is forced to rewrite it in its current form. Since a film about a group of scientists didn't seem commercial to him, he changed it to a group of blue-collar workers instead, and changed the story about them. Ironically, Ghostbusters 2, a film about scientists, was one of the most successful films of that year, while The Abyss, while not a box office flop, was considered to be commercially disappointing.
No, it was a flop.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't spend this kind of money on a movie to make, you know, a little bit more than your budget. You know, you do it to make it a mega hit. So that they were hoping to be like the number one film of the year, and they didn't even come close. I think they had like a 45, well, they say 45 million, but people say it was more than that. And they brought in around 90, I think.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't look up the box office numbers. I figured I had enough facts.
Are you sure you didn't want to look up 18 more facts? Because that's the kind of movie that it is. Like, you didn't even talk about any of the ILM stuff or effects. Or I mean, there's just so many stories. Yeah,
there was.
There's groundbreaking CGI in this movie, and you really can't even get to that part of it.
I read a lot of facts about ILF or...
ILM.
ILM.
Industrial Light and Magic.
Industrial Light and Magic.
Yeah.
I read a lot about them, but I had to cut it off somewhere.
Yeah. Their work, we'll talk about it when we get there. Their work is groundbreaking, but I mean, it's just water with a face now. I mean, I understand what that was in 1989, but at the end of the day, in 2024, if you watch this movie, it's just water with a crappy looking face on it.
Yeah.
So that does deserve to be, I mean, at least mentioned about it, that the effect hasn't aged as well, at least not as well as some other things have. So, listen, I have one more clip that I want to play, and it's about Ed Harris. And the legend on the film is that Ed Harris obviously hated his time and never, ever wants to talk about The Abyss. And, you know, you've heard that story, so.
Yeah, but he talks about it on the documentary.
Yeah. And the thing about it is this is him talking about how this myth got started.
Talk about The Abyss. You know, I remember when that came out, Premiere Magazine did a rather lengthy article about the film, and it made it almost like, you know, a dissension into hell for actors. Do you agree with that assessment, and what are your feelings about that film now?
I think the film's really good for the first 2 hours. I think the last 10 minutes or so is really embarrassing, and that's too bad.
I agree. I hate the ending.
So hard on it for so long. And that Premiere article was really misleading, because I was at a conference, one of these things, with a bunch of writers about talking about another film, Jackknife. And this gentleman from Premiere asked me about The Abyss. And I said, I have nothing to say about The Abyss right now. I'm here to talk about Jackknife. And he persisted and persisted and persisted. And I finally said, look, I got nothing to say about The Abyss, and I never will. And it was kind of like, you know, to you. And so, of course, he writes the article and puts this right up in the middle of the page, which makes it seem like there's this huge crisis of support for the film. I worked on that film much too hard to not support it. It was difficult at times. It was dangerous at times, but it was also, you know, an extremely challenging thing that I felt very good about. So, you know, things get blown out of proportion sometimes.
It's just, that's a quote, and I think as I watched some videos about The Abyss, that's a fact that gets thrown down all the time, that he just refuses to talk about the movie, when really that quote was, you know, no, I'm talking about this. I'm not going to talk about The Abyss, yeah, which is what he said, but that's not how it's reported and how he meant it. Mm. You know, that he will never, ever talk about this one, when he has a few times.
Yeah.
So,
like I said, he talked about it in a documentary, so he has talked about it.
Yeah.
Dude.
Yeah. So I wanted to reiterate that as well.
All right, you ready to go through this movie?
I indeed am. Now you get mad when I have clips.
It began two years ago in an unfinished nuclear power plant. It became one of the most
challenging
motion pictures ever made.
Because it's about how fucking difficult this movie was to make.
The most original adventure of the summer will begin at theaters everywhere. From James Cameron, the writer and director of The Terminator and Aliens, comes The Abyss.
Like, it's just sold on how difficult it was and the pedigree of James
Cameron.
Probably
shouldn't have married her then.
It's kind of wild in 1989. So, I don't know if you knew this trivia fact, but did you know that James Cameron was going through a divorce during this movie?
You don't say. Because it's all over this movie.
Yeah, this is a movie written by a guy going through a bitter, bitter divorce.
Yeah.
With his boss / producer.
Yeah.
So, Gail Ann Hurd, by the way, who's a producer on this film and on Aliens, a fantastic producer, by the way. And their marriage fell apart during the pre-production of this film. And was pretty much torched by the time it was done. And it shows in the screenplay.
Yeah.
And the performances. And the use of the word bitch over and over and over again.
Yeah.
But James Cameron is a crazy person who just happens to make really good movies.
Yeah.
That's kind of what we've learned.
Yeah.
So how's this thing start? How's this gigantic film start?
A submarine comes into focus.
Hey, that was something for the guys watching the video. All two of you.
The crew of the sub are tracking something going 80 knots, which I guess is really fast. I'm not sure.
This opening sequence kicks ass. I love everything with this submarine.
Now it's going 130 knots. 60 yards to contact. Something whizzes past and causes the sub to shake. The sub is shook. The sub is struck by something big, and it starts to sink. The crew are hit with water and sub sinks to the bottom after launching a buoy.
Yeah, and this is actually an incredibly shot sequence as they're trying to save the sub. And like, there's a great sequence where they're trying to shut the water off and it's flowing through. And the guy's like, no, no, no.
Yeah.
This is just an incredibly well done sinking of a sub.
Yeah.
This is a brutal sequence.
Yeah, because all those guys drown.
Yeah, yeah. All the work they do to try to stay alive, and they still fucking drown down there.
Yeah.
And then James Cameron wanted to drown them for real.
That's what we learned.
Yeah.
And then we have a shot of a team landing on the aircraft carrier. They also reveal a woman, which the crew cringes at. So, obviously, she's the bitch woman.
Mm-hmm. I think
the horrible hag.
Yeah. I couldn't even keep track of the number of times they refer to this character as a bitch.
Especially in the beginning. Like, it's not until she settles down and starts acting like a member of the crew where, you know, things get better and she's not called a bitch.
Yeah. But even then she starts calling herself a bitch.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, she's self-aware.
Yeah. She's aware of her bitchiness.
Yeah.
And her bitchdom.
Why not?
Yeah.
Virgil goes to take a call and get the crew together to tell them that the U.S. Montana submarine went down and they want them to go down to the sub and they're willing to pay them a hefty bonus for doing so.
So I like this idea of this blue collar truckers under the sea kind of vibe that the ship has, but I don't think we really get to know a lot of these guys.
Yeah.
And I mean, this movie's fairly long. I know there's a special edition director's cut that we didn't watch, and there's a bit more there, but I mean, I just don't ever really get a feel for who these characters are, except for really our lead characters.
Yeah.
When in Aliens, I don't believe that's the case with another film that he made with a large cast, I guess is sort of what I'm getting at.
Mm-hmm.
I don't feel like this is a great group of characters necessarily, even though that's not the fault of the actors.
No, absolutely not. I feel bad for these poor actors.
Yeah.
Lindsay, who is the bitch girl, talks to Virgil about the mission.
Bitch woman, I think is how we prefer.
Yeah, whatever.
She's the night bitch. Oh, that's Amy Adams.
She gives him a bunch of shit, then signs off. Lindsay takes a crew in a submergible to look for a sub. They dock at the mining station Virgil is on. The crew are interacting in ways that make you think that they all have been working together in a long time.
Yeah.
So there is that.
The one thing
I mentioned it.
So we've seen this scene a bunch of times over the last few weeks. We've seen it in Deep Star 6. We've seen it in Leviathan. I saw it in Lords of the Deep. You know, so, I mean, this idea of the crew sort of bonding so we get a feel for them. Yeah. Now, this is done better than those other films, obviously, because James Cameron knows what he's doing. But as I said, we just don't spend enough time with these guys. I just don't feel like they have enough personality to them where I feel for these other guys in this movie.
Yeah. I agree wholeheartedly with you. Like I said, very hollow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Lindsay walks around like her shit don't stink, annoying the crew and everyone around her.
Yeah.
And
it doesn't stink. We don't know.
Lindsay and Virgil spar a little bit.
Yeah.
Virgil, there's a scene where Virgil, like, is in the bathroom and he drops his ring in the toilet.
Yeah.
So he's like, shit.
Once again, James Cameron doesn't want to see a therapist. He's working out all of his issues in this screenplay. He portrays the strongest woman there as an absolute bitch that everybody sort of despises. And then we get the bathroom sequence here.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I think he tries to put a little spin on it. But I think Cameron's too bitter to put the heart he normally is able to easily put into a lot of his movies.
Yeah.
I don't think he can find it here because he's just that angry about this divorce or that bitter about it. Either way, it's one of those things I think really taints the film. But I like this sequence.
Yeah.
Where he throws the ring into the toilet and he walks out because he's done with her. He hates her. And 5 seconds later, he runs back in there, shoves his hand and pulls it out. And his hand will remain dyed blue for the rest of the film.
Yeah.
Which I like.
Yeah, I know. Me too.
I think, even though I know later on, I'll probably forget. I want to mention it now. When Master Antonio returns and he brings her back, like he caresses her face with the blue hand. And I was like, like, no, not that hand. You can wash it again.
Ugh. I wonder if that was really dye. Like he had to walk around like that. Like Ed Harris had to walk around like that for a while.
You know, most people don't realize this, but Ed Harris is naturally blue. So that's the one part of himself he didn't have to dye for the shoot.
Really? Are you done?
No, I'm never done with you. Lay it on me. What happens next?
Lieutenant Hiram Michael Biehn.
Coffee.
Lays down the law that he is in charge. He tells everyone to prepare to get wet in 15 minutes. And then this is where they drown the rat. But
yeah, they show off the deep diving stuff, and that's one of the elements of it. Like I said, I remember this scene as a kid. I can never forget this scene. So I mean, it's effective, even though, like I said, they did have to torture a rat.
I wrote down odd effect, even though I now know that they actually did that shit for real.
Yeah. You're like, so they built like a fake rat.
Yeah, I was like.
Yeah, I like that. Because you were like, surely they wouldn't torture some poor animal.
Exactly.
This way, right? They wouldn't like drown their animal. It looks so real.
I thought maybe it was CG or
Cameron something. Was like, do it again.
Yeah. I don't know.
That's the only reason he took that one rat home, so he could drown him at his leisure.
Jesus Christ.
Listen, he makes great movies, but every now and then he likes to drown a rat. It's his price.
They take submergibles down where they think the sub could be. They find it. The divers land on the sub. Mm-hmm. They launch an ROV. They open up the hatch at the top of the sub, and the ROV goes in. There's a breach, and they are going to exploit it.
Yeah.
Gain access.
Yeah. So once again, here, this is where we see what we talked about earlier with the guys holding their breath. It's wild.
Yeah. Lieutenant Hiram leads the way. They find their first corpse. They find many, many more.
Yeah, like I said, the ship is literally littered with corpses.
Yeah.
Just floating there. So there's a lot of guys holding their breath, hoping no one lets them down on the regulator.
Yeah. They split up into two teams to explore more thoroughly. Jammer gets spooked after seeing all the death, and Bud calms him down. I'm also going to warn everybody that Virgil and Bud are the same person.
Yeah.
Some characters refer to Virgil as Virgil. Some characters refer to Bud as Bud.
Yeah.
It's either Virgil or Bud. So I want to make sure everybody understands when I refer to Bud, I'm also talking about Virgil.
Yeah. And even Lindsay, she goes back and forth between what she calls him. So, and that'd be the person closest to him.
All right. Jammer starts to freak out again and sees a blue light. It comes towards him. He tries to escape and damages his suit. He starts convulsing. They try to get him out of there. And then a purple light or organism comes towards Lindsay.
Yeah, and this is the first time she gets to see it.
Yeah.
Or gets to, like, know that something's there, necessarily, then get a great look at it.
Yeah, she really is at awe at what she's seeing.
Yeah.
It's a nice moment because it shows her face and how awestruck she is.
Yeah, the once again,
shadow of the purple light.
All the effects are really well done. Even 1989, this
still James Cameron.
Yeah, so all this stuff is still really well crafted. And there's a great level of awe that most people can't really nail that is really well done in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
So, like I said, I mean, even though I didn't think it's a perfect movie, there is some perfect scenes in it.
Yeah, there's some real beauty.
And this is one.
Jammer is in a coma, so he's not waking up anytime soon. Virgil and
so that eliminates him from being able to back up her story about any extraterrestrial or weird light for almost the rest. He does come back. He does wake up near the end of the movie. Though.
Virgil and Lindsay kind of talk, argue about what she saw. And then,
Bud?
Yeah, Bud, whatever, whatever you want to call him. It's up to you. Choose your own adventure.
Yeah. Choose your own character name.
Lieutenant Hiram calls into command. They didn't see anything but reports it.
Oh, we missed the whole explanation about the pressure psychosis.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we missed that whole bit. And this was earlier when they get to the ship and everything like that. You see Lindsay go through the whole explanation about it. And, like, as the scene ends, Michael Biehn gets to, like, his quarters. And, like, the one thing she said is your hands will start shaking. And there's, like, a lingering shot of his hand trembling. And so we know that he has that. And we didn't mention it then, but I wanted to bring it up now. That's a pretty big point is that will slowly grab a hold of him. And I think he does a great job with this performance and with this growing sense of paranoia and growing psychosis.
Yeah, absolutely.
Michael Biehn can play a psycho.
Michael Biehn's the best.
Yeah, he really is great. Yeah. He really is.
I wish he would have done more stuff later on.
Yeah, he was waking and baking during this time. He didn't need to do anything after Terminator.
Yeah, I know.
He was done.
The crew watched the news about the sub. There's a hurricane threatening the mission.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing I love about this hurricane.
Add that on top of the pile.
So when they call up and they confirm that it's Hurricane Frederick, right? Hurricane Fred?
I can't remember.
Yeah, I think it's Hurricane Frederick because there's a joke about hurricanes should always be named after women. And literally as the character says that, the doors open and you hear this giant breeze come in and blow all of his papers and research away for the camera to pan over and reveal Lindsay walking and like.
Yeah.
Like when they did that, I was just like, wow, that was pretty on the nose there.
James Cameron.
Yeah, he just wanted to imply that very, very heavily.
Hiram's crew of guys, they actually go take a missile from the sub.
Yeah.
So that'll come into play later. The hurricane is raising hell on the up top where the ocean ends.
The ocean ends. So the surface.
Yeah, I there think, you go. That, yeah, that
the,
word.
The surface is.
Where, yeah, that word.
Yes, the surface is where the top part of the ship is. So that's hanging out there, and that's a big ass ship that they built out there. It was so big they had to inform the Coast Guard of its existence.
Yeah,
it was a legitimate vessel.
I read that.
Yeah, I wanted to throw that in here when I remembered it, but. They have all kinds of stuff. We have more great effects work as the station slowly comes apart. And this is a thrilling fucking sequence.
The drilling rig starts moving and hits Lisa one night. She's one in one of the submergibles.
Yeah.
Submersibles, whatever. Whatever you want.
A sub?
Yeah.
Yeah. He's in a big sandwich.
A crane holding the rig breaks and falls into the ocean. Basically, everybody in the rig braces for impact.
Yeah, this is the model that comes apart is incredibly, looks just great as it comes down and falls into the ocean. And there's this great building of dread as everyone, like you said, is bracing for impact. They hit the alarms. It's coming down and it builds and the tension builds as you see the crane come down right in front of the structure. They narrowly avoid anything bad happening. It's great because everyone takes a deep breath.
Yeah.
And then the crane slides into the abyss. And so does the cable that connects it to the station.
Mm-hmm.
And more like carnage breaks loose in this. Because like the second they see it go over, they know shit's about to get real. And like this sequence is just really incredible. Like, this is the stuff, like, James Cameron was amazing at.
Yeah. Well, like you said, it falls missing the rig just barely, but it drags him over. A crew member gets hit by an exploding door. It's a really brutal scene because it looks real. It looks like it really happened.
It's like he had fucking leveled.
Yeah. Hippie, which is one of the crew members, goes to rescue his rat and nearly gets hit by a submergible.
Yeah.
Three guys get locked in a room.
The rat's fine. With floating. The rat's fine, by the way. He's floating in like a plastic bag.
Yeah.
It's really cute. Even if it, you know, James Cameron said, can there be less air in there?
I know, right?
Yeah. Can we get less oxygen? Can we just pump some nitrogen in there?
He's fine. He's fine.
Yeah. He likes it.
So the room is filling up with water fast. Unfortunately, those guys drown as Virgil tries to help.
Yeah, they do. I like the way you, unfortunately, those guys drown. Yeah, you should be like a news reporter where you're like, and then like 1,000 people died. I don't know. You know, it was probably bad or something.
Whatever. A couple of guys help Virgil from drowning. He stopped.
Yeah, because he actually gets knocked around. Everybody gets knocked around by the water flowing in.
Yeah.
Like I said, this is just truly chaos in this ship.
He stops a door from closing with his wedding ring.
Yeah, which is very plausible, right?
No.
Well, excuse me, what do you mean?
Well, because most wedding rings are made either out of silver or gold, both being very soft metals, which would easily break with the force of a hydraulic door.
You think so?
Yes.
But James Cameron said it wouldn't.
Well, it's just stupid.
Maybe he has a ring that's made of a stronger metal.
No.
Yeah.
Like adamantium?
You said it, not me. Maybe he has an adamantium ring to signify the power of their love.
It doesn't seem very lovely.
It doesn't seem very lovely. Why not just go out and say it was vibranium 20 years before, 30 years before the MCU? Because you're saying there's no way this would hold up.
Yeah.
Okay. I'm going to call James Cameron. I'm going to call Jim. And I'm going to let him know that you think his movie's shit and his logic is fucking
flawed.
Yeah. His logic is completely flawed. He just says, I've abandoned Avatar 3. I'm going into exile.
I'm going to go drown more rats.
Yeah. He's like, I'm going to get back to what I really love doing, which is torturing rats and Mary Elizabeth, Master Antonio. I'm coming, Mary Elizabeth.
Master Antonio.
Yeah. He just grabs Winston instead. See what I did there. Yeah. Like, no.
Okay.
All right. We went on an adventure with James Cameron, the killer and torturer.
Oh, man.
All right, let's keep going.
Virgil walks around surveying his crew. Lindsay heads out in diving gear. She makes it to the crane.
Yeah.
The blue entity shows up again.
Yeah, she's able to get an even better look at it this time, and we see more of it as well.
It stares at Lindsay. Then moves on. Then a massive ship shows up. Lindsay reaches out and touches the ship.
There's a weird tactile feel to this scene. Like it's actually there as opposed to like what CG even can do today. It's also probably like, you know, the lighting and stuff that's actually on Lindsay's face and stuff like that.
She tries to get a pic of it, but it scurries away before she could.
Mm-hmm.
Then Lindsay and crew talk about what she saw. She's very vocal about what she saw.
Yeah, this time she very much is like, okay, listen, there's something else out there. It's not a Russian sub, dumbass. This is something else.
They talk of aliens and get a little excited.
Yeah.
Lindsay makes a plea to Virgil about what she saw. She wants him to believe her. We have a scene where Hippie spies on Lieutenant Hiram and sees them prepping a missile. He records it and shows Virgil. Lindsay sees it and breaks into the room. She just charges in there.
Yeah, she really does. What a bitch. Did you know she was a bitch?
Yeah, I know, right? She bursts in through the door and starts immediately yelling at Lieutenant Hiram.
I mean, as she should in the situation, to be honest. Yeah. She's trying to get everybody killed, especially me.
Lieutenant gets the crazy eye and says they can't trust anyone.
Yeah, because at this point he is full, like, I look like I'm a crazy, trembling son of a bitch.
Yeah. There's a nice lull in the movie where all the crew is sleeping.
Yeah.
Then we get an alien POV. He gets into the rig and goes through the halls.
So we have this. This is an iconic sequence here.
It spots a man sleeping and then another crew member. Lindsay wakes up seeing the creature. She wakes up Virgil and the rest of the crew. The creature mimics Lindsay's face.
Yeah.
Then Lindsay touches it and it's made of seawater, confirmed by her tasting it. It retreats and they go after it. It lands in the missile room, then gets cut off by the lieutenant.
Yeah, who has no interest in this alien phenomena. So this is the birth of CGI.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, not really, but this is probably the first time it really mattered in a movie to try to make it look like there was something that was actually there.
Yeah.
And it, now for 89, it's amazing. And, you know, the effect is still pretty good today.
Yeah.
But, you know, like I said, it's just a very simple thing. And it really did take them like 6 months to do. It was the very first thing that they shot on the production schedule, because if it didn't work, they were going to have to go with like the backup plans of stop motion animation or a weird tentacle idea they had. So, you know, it's a good thing that it did work because it laid the foundation for Terminator 2.
Yeah.
So that's the great thing that came out of almost killing Ed Harris is we got T2.
Yeah. I think we were going to get T2 no matter what.
You don't know that.
Because he was so obsessed with that technology.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, but if it didn't work here, he wouldn't have done T2.
I don't know.
Yeah, if like he would, let's say.
I think he would have waited for the technology.
I think, yeah, probably. But you understand he had to break that technology. No one else did it. He was the one who had to be like, no, we can do this for real. Like, so someone else was going to have to cross that bridge before he even thought about it.
Yeah.
Because he would have tried and it didn't work. So this really is a monumental moment in effects. And the only reason it worked is because, like I said, I mean, the number of rats he killed per day just increased the chances that the CGI would be better. Or at least that's how Cameron felt about it.
Yeah, it's like those people that say if you torture a dog, it tastes better.
Yeah, that's the same thing. If you torture a rat under production, the movie quality goes higher and higher.
Exactly.
Yeah. Like on the first Avatar, he was just snapping necks of rats like date, like by every minute. And now he's made over $1 billion.
Well, our crew here, they talk about the phenomenon. And they're all talking, the lieutenant is silently cutting his wrists and arm under the table. He's got the madness.
Yeah, they really want to show this to you here. And like I said, Vine's doing a great job running the fine line between being a bit subtle about it to now just chewing the scenery about his growing madness.
Hippie watches a guy get the missile ready. Lieutenant catches him. Lieutenant's crew put everyone in a room and seal it off. But Jammer wakes up and rescues Virgil and the crew just in time. Bud, or Virgil, whichever you prefer
yeah, in this situation,
volunteers to swim and open a door for them to get out of there. They make it to one of the hatch, but can't open it. Bud swims further as another guy stays behind. He makes it to the room Lieutenant is in. He sneaks around. He goes to try.
So there's a lot of swimming under the water here without a suit by Ed Harris, who is being chlorine to death out in the water.
Yeah. I know. These poor guys. They bonk Lieutenant over the head.
Yeah. So I like the idea that Virgil here wants to try to sneak attack a Navy SEAL.
Yeah.
You know,
crazy Navy.
Yeah. Crazy Navy SEAL at that. And he gets very lucky. The gun misfires and they have as good a job as he can fighting this guy. And it really does. He tries to do as good as, I mean, anybody hopes they can hold their own for a few moments against a Navy SEAL.
Yeah. A knife fight ensues. Lieutenant beats up Bud pretty well, but Cat rescues Bud. Lieutenant gets in a submersible and escapes with the nuke.
Yeah, he's punched in the face so hard the frame goes white for one moment.
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah, he is hit hard, knocked down, but he does escape and they shoot into the water, right?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know how they did that?
Mm-mm.
They actually use live ammo.
Oh, yeah, I did read that.
Yeah. That's a rare situation where you'd use live ammunition.
But they mounted the camera so nobody had to man it.
Yeah.
That's how they got the shot.
Yeah.
They get Virgil into a suit quickly and he goes and tries to stop Lieutenant. Lieutenant releases the ROV with the nuke, but Bud ties it off before it can go anywhere. Lieutenant tries to ram him with a submersible, but Lindsay is in a separate submersible with Bud.
They're going to have a submarine ram fight.
Yeah, with Bud. He gets in. They try and keep the nuke from going anywhere. Lieutenant thwarts their plans. He keeps ramming them. Lindsay maneuvers and rams Lieutenant, but they get intertwined together. The submersible with Lieutenant tumbles to the depths and explodes after the pressure is too much.
So I had such a fond memory of this entire battle sequence, but really watching it back, it's just a few slow-moving submarines kind of colliding into each other for a few minutes.
Yeah.
I mean, this is probably one of the weaker action sequences of James Cameron's career. I think that sort of goes without saying. It's a little disappointing, even if it does have a great end where the submarine begins to crack from the pressure and you hear Michael Biehn just scream as it all comes in. Those air bubbles come up. That's really cool.
Yeah.
And it does have like such a cool ending, but I thought this was a little underwhelming.
Well, Lindsay and Bud are trapped in their submersible. They're trying to reach the rig for help, but no such luck.
Yeah. They took some major damage from everything.
They talk strategy, but their options are limited. I love this whole sequence.
Yeah. This is truly amazing.
Sorry.
Yeah, you love to hit that goddamn microphone.
I love, love, love this whole sequence.
Yeah. The slow-building tension as the water rises, and the water rises fast, faster than you think it's going to rise. It really is just a thing of beauty, how it builds, and you think there can be another solution, and next thing you know, she's gasping her last breath.
Yep. Bud wants her to put his suit on, but Lindsay protests.
It's a stupid
idea. She says she's willing to drown, but she freaks out as the water rises. She drowns as Virgil watches. Then he tows her back to the rig.
Great scream by Ed Harris. No!
They get the defibrillator and such to save her life. Virgil does what he can for her, but it's too late. Virgil continues compression sets, but she clearly's dead. This scene goes on forever, but fucking Lindsay comes back to life.
Yeah. I think this is like, I don't know, this bad CPR or whatever.
Yeah.
Because by the end, Ed Harris is just beating the shit out of Mary Elizabeth Master Antonio. And this is the scene she walked out on.
Yeah.
This is the scene she walked out on. They got up and they said, "We're not animals." And she left the set and never returned. She threw a flaming Molotov cocktail at James Cameron. But no, this is an intense sequence. I don't know if I really like this scene, though, this end part.
Yeah.
I think I might have found the film more impactful had she died. Is that weird to say?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I might have felt, because he just does CPR for, like, ever, and she just comes back.
Yeah, it's not.
Because he's like, don't, keep fighting, you bitch.
Because they stop, saying, take a break.
Yeah, saying bitch was the key to bringing her back. That's how James Cameron's life works. He's like, you just call a woman a bitch enough, she'll come back to life to chew your ass out.
Yeah.
You just call her a bitch and kill rats over, on top of her.
Well, they come up with a plan and they strap Virgil into his suit and flood it, breathing in that special
water. So when I told you that Ed Harris is actually just holding his breath in between the takes, you looked at me and went like, come on. You think I'm stupid? No. Like you didn't believe that that was the actual solution when we watched the movie. But that is really all that's going on here. There's no double pane glass or anything like that. He's getting that helmet flooded with that chlorinated fluid and then just opening the helmet to breathe at the end of a take.
Ugh.
That's insane.
He ventures into the abyss with a rover. He's 3,200 feet below, past the crane. He's 1 mile down and still going. 8,500 feet depth.
And this is, I remember even from watching this movie as a kid, I remember this scene vividly where he has to go down there and he can only communicate via the
type.
The keyboard.
8,900 feet. The whole time. And Virgil's hands are starting to shake. He's 16,000 feet and going a little crazy, talking gibberish. He slips further and further down. He says he sees light everywhere, but he makes it to where the bomb is.
Yeah, and they say that's part of him hallucinating and going crazy.
Or is it?
He tries to disarm it. It cuts, and he ends up cutting the right wire as he disarms it.
This is actually a nice little bit right here as he gets down there. And they're like, cut the blue and the white wire. And then the green light doesn't show any difference. Yeah. Oddly enough, I was like, this is very James Cameron to give this gigantic world ending implication of a possible start of World War III, and to come down to this little tiny relatable fact that the stupid light makes these two wires look the same.
Yeah.
And, you know, he puts it on the one, changes his mind, and everything turns out okay. Except,
you know, unfortunately, yeah, he doesn't have enough oxygen to survive the trip back. He decides he's going to stay a little.
Yeah. And I think this is where some of the emotion in the movie comes, mm-hmm, finally. You know, when she's sort of there, like, screaming at him. Like, no, you drop your weights. You come back now.
He types, love you, wife. And Lindsay cries. But the blue light comes for Bud.
Yeah. And this looks great, by the way.
It reaches out a hand and takes Bud to his ship. They leave him in a chamber with oxygen. The aliens interact with Bud.
There's a great sequence of him going into the ship.
Yeah.
Which is very 2001-esque that I like quite a bit. And I just wanted to mention that, like, that's just another great effect sequence of them just going through the ship.
I found this whole last sequence really grating.
Yeah, I think this end part isn't particularly satisfying.
No.
And that's putting it mildly. I think it's very underwhelming for what I think you would expect for the end of a movie this harrowing.
I would have liked a movie, when you have a title such as The Abyss.
Yeah.
You're expecting something hardcore or something gritty or a monster of some sort. Something coming out of the abyss that you're like, ah.
Yeah.
This movie was not that.
Well, I don't necessarily have a
problem. They hint at it in the beginning.
They do.
They hint at it.
Yeah.
But in the end, it's just friendly aliens.
I don't have a problem with the aliens being friendly. But I think, you know, we'll talk about it a little bit later. I think Siskel puts it nicely, where he's like, these aliens just aren't as charming as somebody like E.T. or the aliens from Close Encounters. I mean, I don't know why I need to care about these aliens other than they have all this power. I know they get expanded upon in the special edition, but I think them almost destroying the world makes even less sense.
Yeah.
And that's not a particular part of James Cameron's filmography I really care for, to be honest.
The crew is looking for Bud up top. And on the rig, he makes contact and says he's coming up, and he comes up with the ship.
Yeah. They have one throwaway line about decompression to get around that plot hole.
Yeah.
I think James Cameron realized it late and was like, oh, shit, I didn't think about that.
It's a giant alien ship that lifts the ship they're on out of the water, including the rig. Bud comes out and of the alien ship, and that's all she wrote.
Yeah, and I think there's a little bit more in the director's special edition with the aliens being a little bit more malevolent, but I don't think that helps other than it's a nice effect scene. And even though apparently when they showed it to test audiences, the wave effect wasn't done. So James Cameron just had like a storyboard in there and people were displeased by it. So that's a reason that his ending got booted as well.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't very well liked by test audiences. Yeah, the ending really doesn't help the picture at all.
No.
I think when things need to come together, I think you can even leave Ed Harris at the bottom of the ocean, you know. That's a weirdly fitting image, you know.
Yeah.
Or the alien even just coming to sit with him at the very end of the world, you know, or the very end of his existence. Whatever it is, like, I don't believe this film comes together in a meaningful way. I don't think the aliens were that important to the story for this to really matter. Yeah. I think when it makes a pivot to these aliens, I don't think that they carry enough emotional weight to really have an impact on the ending, to make you feel anything at this moment in the movie other than, hey, that's kind of a neat effect. And that's really all they end up being, a neat effect.
Yeah.
Sadly. Like I said, this is, you pointed out, hollow. And I think that's probably the best way to put it. I will still stick by my rating of a 7 for the movie because I still think it's that expertly crafted. But it is certainly the James Cameron film I'm least excited about.
I would have given it a 5. But I feel like James Cameron comes with a certain level of quality for any movie.
Yeah. And the underwater stuff is still unmatched.
And the underwater stuff is so good. And there's some good scenes in this movie.
There's great scenes in it.
There's some good interacting between the actors. But I don't like the ending. I don't like the friendly aliens. And
they needed to kill us all.
Well, something interesting. Some more people needed to die.
Well, I think they just needed another hook on that finale. There just had to be something else. And whatever it was, it just didn't come together for James Cameron.
Well, reviews for this movie are pretty good. 4.4 user review, 89% on Rotten Tomatoes, and a 7.5 out of 10 on IMDb.
Technically, we're giving it a positive score. You think about it. Because you're giving it a 6 and I'm giving it a 7. That would be fresh on Rotten Tomatoes.
I did, however, find a 1-star review.
Lay it on me.
It's a good thing that James Cameron ended up directing Titanic. If he hadn't, he might have ended up being remembered for this. And no one would have want that hanging around their neck like a milestone for all eternity. The first 10 minutes or so of The Abyss are fine. Good, even. As a U.S. nuclear submarine sinks after encountering some mysterious force off the coast of Cuba, from there, the whole thing falls apart. The cast, headed by Ed Harris, appears wooden and uninterested and has no discernible chemistry.
I don't know if I ever called Ed Harris wooden.
The story never really seems to get set a direction and follow it. It tries to be part Cold War thriller, part alien encounter stuff, part disaster epic. Then it tries to blend them all together in a movie that is nothing less than dull. And that seems to go on and on and on. And did I mention that it seems like it's never going to end? And when it does end, it leaves you wondering why you bothered watching this thing for almost 3 hours. This really is bad.
Well, he certainly disliked it a lot more than you did. I will say that.
Yeah, he did. He gave it a 1-star. I give it 6.
Yeah, no, I think that guy was far too harsh for the movie. I mean, you can't dismiss, like I said, the craftsmanship. And there are many great scenes in this movie, classic scenes.
Yeah.
I just don't think like its whole really comes together as nicely as I'd like. But, you know, with that, we finally finish our triplets of aquatic terror films, even though there was no real horror in this movie.
We didn't do our social medias.
Oh, we didn't?
No.
There's no time for social media. There's only time for Roger Ebert.
Yeah.
Because in the year of 1989, he was very much alive. And if Roger Ebert was alive now, how would he get a hold of us?
He would email us.
He would email from the grave.
GrittyRebootCast@gmail.com.
And if he could get his zombie hands on a phone, he could just search for Gritty Reboot on TikTok, Instagram, and on YouTube.
Yeah.
And that's the best way to find us. And now it's buried in the show, and we're part of Ebert forever.
Yep.
So, do you think Ebert liked the movie?
No.
So, I want to remind you, by the way, it's your job to do the social media thing.
Your job.
It's the only thing I give you on the show to do.
I know,
but during the show, you've got to be like, hey, social media. It's okay. We'll power through.
High-tech underwater adventure film called The Abyss, and it's really two stories, and we're getting a lot of pictures that have two elements, and they don't blend well together, but one of them I think is very good. That's the story of an attempt to remove the nuclear missiles from a sunken atomic submarine. I don't like it when I end up agreeing with Siskel. Leading the attempt are a couple of married and feuding undersea oil rig workers, played by Ed Harris and Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio.
I was worried about the rig. I've got over 4 years invested in this project.
Yeah, you only had 3 years invested in me.
Well, you have to have priorities. Nothing.
Underwater, the two of them have to deal with their crew, one of whom is paranoid about both the American and Russian military.
You know, we've got Russian subs creeping around. Anything goes wrong down here, they could think whatever they want happen. Give the folks medals.
Relax, will you? You're making the women nervous.
You're making me nervous.
Buddy's not completely paranoid, as the couple finds out when an American officer attacks them in a mini-sub.
Go to the right. Swing to the right.
The underwater action is terrific, but the film goes aground when it tries for profundity with a close encounter with an E.T. clone.
I seem to be having a problem here.
Oh, we're all having problems.
The Alien story really splits this movie in two, turning it from a hard-edged drama into a fairy tale that doesn't stand up by comparison with
either Close Encounters,
E.T., or 2001. Still, yeah. I enjoyed the main part of the movie, the claustrophobic tension underwater. I recommend it with a strong reservation about the creature from beyond. I wish they just built that whole idea.
I didn't mind the creature from beyond because it seemed to me that what it gave us was another level of fun for a movie that is basically a lot of fun, and I enjoyed
it. He liked it.
Yeah, you said it was two stories.
I was surprised.
I thought you were going to say that the other story was the relationship between Harris and Master Antonio, mm-hmm. whether or not they'll get back together again.
Oh, that I know.
But I enjoyed that when she's trying to talk him through his, when he's going to have a panic attack when he's down at 40,000 feet.
That part I like.
Deep he was. This movie has great special effects.
Yes, it does.
Convinced me that we were underwater.
Yes, it did.
And you could see what was happening. Oftentimes they try to fudge underwater movies by putting everything in a big cloud of sand or something so that you can't see that it's only models or something. This movie looked good, and I thought it was very exciting. I thought the ending, of course.
Cheap.
I mean, we could have taken the last 5 minutes and just not had them. And
didn't
we
even,
had
a, didn't
everybody hates this ending.
Cheap.
Yeah, I mean, it was photographed on bad stock or something.
The ending was not the best part of the movie, but I enjoyed it. Another thing I liked, it was produced by this woman, Gail Ann Hurd, who also made Aliens, which starred Sigourney Weaver. And it's the same idea, which is that the action character, the leader of the group, is a woman. And that provides a whole different dynamic for the whole crew that is interesting. It makes a lot of the cliches seem a little fresher.
Yeah, but the problem is that the woman, at least in this case, I think, acts so macho that it gets a little corny.
Well, if you were the boss of an undersea oil rig and you were a woman, wouldn't you act a little macho when you're down there?
I probably would, but I'm watching it as a movie and I'm seeing it's a little bit out there. The problem for me is I say the alien stuff. Wouldn't you have liked the picture better if they hadn't had aliens down there and just spent more time with the rescue?
I just think they just put in another element that was more fun.
It doesn't work
for
me. Now let's take another look at the movies we reviewed on this show.
Now listen to this recap.
Two thumbs up for Brian De Palma's Casualties
of War. You're going to be pissed
in a minute. A small but
Casualties of War, great film, by the way. Underrated.
Featuring strong performances by both Sean Penn and Michael J. Fox. Two thumbs down, way down, for the hippie comedy Rude Awakening.
Oh, wrong movie.
Bad acting and an insufferable script. Two more thumbs down for Uncle Buck, starring John Candy wise uncle. The film could use more dark moments. Two thumbs up for the
Abyss. Dark moments?
I didn't watch the review.
I, however, didn't care for the alien creature that makes its supporting appearance.
Wow.
And two thumbs down for A Chorus of Disapproval, the small...
Two thumbs down to you.
Yeah, you are no fan of Siskel and Ebert on this one. I heard that, and I was going to cut that down. I was like, no, I'm leaving that in, because I know you're going to be pissed off about that.
Yeah.
You now, next week, you want the Ebert section removed from the show.
Uncle Buck.
Yeah, I don't know how they gave it a bad review.
Classic.
But they didn't like
movie.
It. They didn't like it.
People to this day like that movie.
Yeah, no, you're 100% right.
New kids are discovering it all the time.
Yeah. And they didn't care for it.
Our daughter will also watch it one day.
She's going to watch it right when we leave this podcast. just so you can show Gene Siskel in hell who's right.
Yeah. All right, we did it.
It's over. We covered The Abyss. We covered Deep Star 6. And, you know, we have a schedule and we don't have it in front of us right now. And I don't know what else we're doing next week.
I forgot what we're doing next week.
Yeah.
But we have it planned out, guys.
Yeah, we do. We have it planned.
We should be proud of it. We made a
schedule where we got a whole thing we're going to stick to. We're going to try to get back to doing some live streams.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're going to have some fun. Seriously, follow us on social media. If you're here at this point, you might as well. But seriously, guys, we'll be back next week for more reboot fun.
Bye.
See you. I didn't press record.